Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, the battles and the changes arising from the so-called disruptors, such as Uber, Lyft, and Airbnb. We're joined by Sarah Kane. She's associate professor at the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia, and she's been studying the global phenomenon of the so-called sharing economy. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Sarah Kane. It's great to have you here with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
So you've been writing for this publication, The Conversation, about how this so-called sharing economy has been shifting and changing. Your latest piece about that part of it, like Uber, the ride sharing, the task rabbits, this end of it that deals with so-called independent contractors. I thought perhaps what we should start with is kind of a big picture about how these new emergent companies like Airbnb, Uber, Lyft, TaskRabbit, all of these, how are they changing the economy?
All of the companies that you've listed, that you've named, are really about changing how services are delivered. And the good thing about them, the attractive thing about them, is the immediacy. And so in a world where we're used to things being immediate, we're used to, you know, cutting through the middlemen and getting the things we want quite quickly, these types of services provide that. So Uber, you know, you directly contact a driver. Airbnb, you directly contact the providers of your accommodation. So as consumers, we're very attracted to this and the immediacy of these services. Now, not all of the companies are the same in terms of how they deliver their service. So some still rely on workers to deliver those services, whereas others, it's not such an issue. Say with Airbnb, it is a different kind of regulatory set of concerns rather than sort of labour standards or labour issues, if you like. So not all participants in the sharing economy are the same for a start. And often that's with perceived benefits to consumers. The downside of that is that these disruptors often don't regard and respect existing regulations, which have come about historically to protect either consumers or workers or other participants in the economy. So there's both up and downsides to this idea of disrupting the traditional way we consumed goods and services.
So one of the aspects of this that you're talking about, the disruption that other scholars have also talked about, deals with how we're moving to this independent contractor sort of society where people are working all the time, not getting to take holidays, not getting the kind of benefits they're used to having whenever they work for a company for a long time. And then on the other side of it, which you've also written about, deals with how do you regulate these things? We've had these regulatory structures that have been in place to protect, like you mentioned, consumers, people who would use the services, as well as workers. This new model has been working outside of these legal paradigms, so to speak, up until more recently. You've been tracking some of the changes, so why don't you elaborate on what's happening here and how the battle has been ensuing?
You started there by talking about, I guess, independent contracting and how these services are based on this idea of a very flexible workforce that sort of dip in and out of providing these services as suits them. And there's something quite attractive about that for some people, that they can, you know, use excess resources, excess time to get some extra work and make some extra money. The problem with that is increasingly people are relying on this kind of work as their main form of work. And it takes us back to sort of pre-regulation of the labour market, if you like. So the time before we had minimum standards. And so that's the danger, that this kind of system erodes what has been built up for legitimate reasons. So that's the first part of it. I guess the second part in terms of what has been happening is that there's been a level of engagement between stakeholders, regulators, and these sharing economy type operators. But the most obvious case, the most publicised case, has been that of Uber. And Uber has quite deliberately and overtly said that it's prepared to circumvent pretty much any regulation that interrupts with how it wants to provide its service. There's been different responses from regulators around the world. So we know in France, very recently, the managers of Uber in France have been prosecuted over this kind of flagrant flouting of regulation. But in Australia, in some jurisdictions, we've had a sort of tentative step towards including Uber into a regulatory framework. Now, that's okay to a degree, but we've also seen people on the streets protesting against what they see is Uber's means of operation. So it's kind of multi-layered. You have the formal regulation, which has been varied across the world, and then you have, I guess, the enforced regulation, which is workers deciding whether or not they think what's happening is fair, and that's where we've seen protests by Uber drivers and by regular taxi drivers against what they see as unfair practices of Uber.
You had mentioned in one of your articles earlier some of the other countries. Just now you mentioned France, but you also have written about what's happened in Hong Kong, for example, and in South Korea, also in India. Can you give us some ideas of what's been happening in these countries?
It has been a bit mixed. One interesting trend, if you like, is that in some of these countries, local competitors, often supported by the state or by other companies, have emerged to compete with Uber. So while Uber was out front and attempting to get to break into markets and based their expansion strategy on that, their approach has not necessarily been without issues in the terms that it's been backfired to a degree that states, governments have said, well, we're not sure that this is the right way to go. What can we do to support competitors? So in China, there's been some local competitors in India. Now, they haven't had the traction that Uber has yet, but there's certainly been this development of this competition in terms of ride sharing, which Uber may have predicted, but may not have predicted rolling out in the way that it has.
You mentioned some legal issues. I think South Korea was one where you said there were 30 people charged with running an illegal taxi firm. There was, I think you mentioned in the same article, about in Hong Kong, where these drivers were arrested for illegally hiring out their vehicle. And then, of course, we've got the legal fights going on in, say, Los Angeles and Seattle. Can you tell us a little more about those?
So just to carry on a little bit, in Australia as well, we've had in various jurisdictions Uber drivers prosecuted for not complying with regulations. So it's been a very mixed, again, at multi-level. So it's often the drivers who are the ones that are prosecuted because they're the ones that can be found actually flouting a law. So Uber isn't necessarily the one that's in the firing line, although certainly it's been Uber's practice to cover fines and legal costs of drivers to date. Although in Australia, we've seen Uber, it has said it will cover fines, but hasn't actually done so, hasn't actually put up the money in some cases. So the other cases are really about, again, because of the way that Uber's been operating, the regulatory issues are also multifaceted. So there's tax issues, there are labour regulation issues, there are safety issues. So in terms of the legality or the potential areas of risk for Uber as a company, it's not just labour law that it's sort of coming up against and facing cases and prosecution about. It's also areas to do with, you know, the safety of consumers. In Australia, there's been concern, there's been a subject of an ongoing Senate inquiry about tax evasion by big companies like Uber. So we have the sort of more prominent cases we know in California of drivers making the argument that they are not independent contractors, that they are in fact employees, and that's an ongoing case that Uber has been challenging through the process. Again, if Uber has taken the decision, and their CEO has been quite open about this, to take on any regulation, whether it's labour law, whether it's to do with safety of consumers, whether it's to do, they're going to take it on. Now, in some cases, they've accepted, you know, some form of regulatory oversight, as in Australia, because the regulators have also moved. But certainly their approach has been and their strategy has been, we will take on and challenge existing frameworks everywhere that we go. And the onus will be on other people and regulators and governments to make us do this. We will not voluntarily comply with anything that exists.
So they really almost model a Wild West type of work environment, everybody on his own.
That's a fantastic analogy. It is the Wild West. And their argument is very much, this is uncharted territory. This is, you know, this is the Wild West. There is nothing here before us. This is their argument, that there has been nothing here before us in this space. Therefore, we get to determine what happens. Now, the implications of that for organisations, for how we deal with corporates, is frightening. That's what we assume is okay. That because something is, you know, that there's a sexy new app that's been developed, that it's okay to say, well, nothing else applies to us. Now, we've come a long way in terms of how we deal with the corporate sector in appropriate regulation. I think we've come a bit too far to accept that as an excuse from organisations, particularly, you know, large organisations that have the resources to comply. I mean, Uber is an extremely cashed up organisation.
Right. And in fact, you mentioned that Uber has been hiring some pretty high-level people for its lobbying. Can you tell us about this?
Yes. We started this conversation talking about the sharing economy. And I think it's really important that we understand that the sharing economy covers a range of participants. And so when we think sharing economy, we think of, you know, little micro-startups, neighbourhood startups, you know, working together, sharing resources, sort of being environmental and that kind of thing. Uber is a big multinational company. It seeks to minimise tax. It seeks to minimise legal obligations. And it seeks to, like other big organisations we've seen in other traditional industries, it seeks to influence and lobby decision makers. And in doing so, it has been quite strategic about employing very well qualified lobbyists, advocates, public relations people, including David Plouffe, who of course was very instrumental in Obama's campaigns, and Rachel Whetstone, who was the former head of Google Communications, as well as, you know, ex-chief of staff to governors, etc. So Uber is being very, very strategic about engaging with regulators to shape the environment that they would most like to see for themselves. Now, I should say, Uber's not Robinson Crusoe on this aspect, but it is behaving very much like an established, traditional corporate player, not some kind of trendy, cutting-edge, small sharing economy participant.
Now, in one case that you wrote about, which was the California Labor Commission decision, I guess it was a decision that Uber was a sham contracting. How do we distinguish what that means exactly?
In Australia, we have quite a different set of labour laws than you have in the US. So we have particular definitions of what sham contracting means. But the same, I guess the same theory applies wherever you are. It's a question of what kind of responsibility do you have to the person that you're contracting to. So with regards to Uber, does Uber have control over the work of the drivers? What is the degree of that control? Do the drivers have the capacity to engage in work for others as well? But a key aspect is control. And if we think about Uber, they really performance manage their drivers quite stringently. So there's the consumer rating, if you like, of Uber drivers. So consumers, people who take an Uber car, can rate their driver. Now, Uber then determines whether that driver can keep driving for them based on those consumer results. So effectively, we're seeing quite a tight level of control between Uber and the drivers, and a performance management system akin to performance management systems you'd see, you know, in other organisations. So one of the things that's looked at, and various jurisdictions have various ways of measuring, what types of levels of control does the company have over the employee? Are there things that tie that driver or that contractor to the company that sort of makes it quite exclusive? And if we think about Uber, there's a particular app that's used, and that's how work is distributed. So there's various measures. And if these measures, depending on the jurisdiction, are found to exist, so whether there's control, whether there's, you know, sort of fairly exclusive work arrangements, that kind of thing, then it's decided, well, that worker is an employee. That's not truly independent. It's at least dependent contracting, and at worst, it's a sham contract.
Now, your most recent piece pertained to labor unions, and in contrast to Uber, and in perhaps conjunction with Uber, where you noted that there is a sort of a crisis among labor unions and so few people being members, but that there's this sort of parallel emergence among organizing with Uber drivers. So let's take a look there and how you have articulated one or two possible scenarios of labor unions learning from, working alongside, working with Uber drivers. How do you see that?
You've laid out, I guess, some of the issues for those organizations seeking to represent workers in the sharing economy, Uber drivers, etc. And labor unions around the world, well, in developed countries, have been suffering declines amongst traditional areas of work, let alone areas which are much more amorphous and difficult to get to. But what we've seen is a kind of grassroots, very organic resistance to some of the activities of Uber and other companies, organised by drivers and workers themselves, using techniques based on social media, etc., to form sort of much more, fluid collectives, if you like, than we would be used to in the traditional labour movement. Sort of the argument that we're putting forward is that unions need to be a lot more, not just receptive, because I think they would be, but a lot more alert to opportunities to work with these more fluid collectives of workers. And often existing structures of labour unions don't necessarily allow them to take advantage of or to work in coalition with these kinds of collectives as they arise, or to even be aware of them. And so we're really advocating for unions to really think about how they might be able to work. And it might be a much more temporary arrangement than we're used to, you know, than someone signing up to a union for the term of their working life. So being a lot more flexible about how they engage with workers on particular issues of importance to them. The other thing is really that we're thinking about is, let's take Uber as an example. Uber, there are a lot of Uber drivers. And so that even accessing, you know, a small percentage of those workers through engagement with social media and other ways provides quite a basis of potential change and potential power to change organisations like Uber. So it's almost a necessity for unions to figure out how they engage because of the scale of these workforces. And things are only going to get worse for them if they really can't come to terms with that.
One of the things that you wrote about in this context was how unions have been sort of stuck in the past in terms of how they do things and the model that they use. And should they update the model, they could end up reinvigorating the entire union movement. What are some of the ways that you see that they could update their model? You mentioned social media as an example. You mentioned being more fluid. But there are some other things that you mentioned in the article as well.
The first thing is I don't think unions will ever replace face-to-face contact with workers. I think that's what gives them, you know, detail and understanding of what's happening with workers, but it's not enough. I think we often think the easy fix is, you know, if we just get a Facebook page as a union, if we just post some tweets, then that means that we're engaging in the social media space and there'll somehow be some big organic uprising amongst our potential members. But I think unions have to become a lot more sophisticated about how they approach technology altogether. So thinking about getting people with expertise on web analytics, people who are actually monitoring what's happening out there on non-labour movement social media, engaging with it, trying to build those links with organisations and with groupings of workers that already exist. So I think, you know, developing a Facebook page, posting some tweets, yeah, okay, that's one side of it, but I think it has to be a much deeper upskilling, if you like, of labour unions to understand the power of, you know, big data, when you can get in and see what people are doing on the net, you can see how they're engaging with different types of social media. So I think it might be supplementing what have been, you know, traditional labour movement strengths of face-to-face organising with people within unions who have the skills to understand the technology much more deeply than being able to post on social media. The other thing is that, and I know there are some examples in Australia, and I know unions have been trying in various contexts to also grapple with the fact that labour law actually is not where the main game is anymore. So unions have to be prepared not just to rely on labour lawyers and trying to engage with the system that already exists. But in some ways, like Uber is trying to pioneer its regulatory environment, unions, labour organisations have to think about how they shape the regulatory environment, what kinds of other legal avenues, regulatory avenues, et cetera, they might explore that isn't sort of in their traditional purviews, and that the structure of organisations, including the sharing economy, but including franchising, including, you know, quite convoluted supply chain construction in modern organisations, mean that unions have to figure out how they regulate, what pressure points are going to be, how they leverage these new configurations of organisations and consequently of working relationships.
One of the things that you said in this last piece was to retool for a post-employment workplace.
Exactly. And that's basically the summary of what I've just said. So we no longer have workplaces looking like they used to. So what does that mean, and what do unions need to be able to do their important job, which is represent workers who aren't neatly located in a factory, in a shop, in an office, and that does require retooling.
You had written out a couple of scenarios about how you see this all playing out. Scenario one dealt with like these individual lawsuits, class actions, aggressive regulation, and what might happen there. Scenario two was Uber adopting a risk mitigation strategy. Why don't you expound on those two possible scenarios about how you see this turning out?
You know, the first scenario is that it becomes to be the aggressive approach of Uber does not make business sense anymore, that the business case for that is starting to fail because the costs are just too big, competition is increasing. And in that case, Uber decides that it needs to, it either gets knocked out from the regulators say this is not going to happen, and so Uber either has to change or die. The second scenario really is that Uber strategically looks around and sees what's happening, sees if it needs to be a bit more pliable in some situations, but really where it can keep adopting its Wild West strategy, it does. And that, of course, we know that Uber's investing in, you know, self-driving cars. That would seem to be, if from a business perspective, that would seem to be a sensible option for Uber, and circumvents a whole lot of these issues about regulating for labour standards, as well as saving them a huge amount of money long term. I would suggest that second scenario where Uber strategically looks around and says, well, okay, say for example in Australia, there's been some movement on regulation, we will comply with this lighter regulation. Australia's not a big market. In the meantime, we'll keep pursuing what we want to do in China, in India, in South America, in areas where, you know, we feel we can still pursue a much more aggressive Wild West strategy. And that seems to be what they're doing. And I would imagine that's what they would continue to do unless there's some very unpredicted shift in those larger markets.
One of the fights that has been going on in the U.S. is in Seattle, along with one of the Teamsters. I think it's the Local 117. Have you been following that?
I haven't been following it as closely as I might, but I do understand that the Teamsters have been trying to be quite active, particularly in Seattle.
And it sounds like what they're doing are some of the things that you have articulated that labor should be doing.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I definitely don't want to suggest that unions aren't trying to engage in this space. And the Teamsters have been promoting an app-based drivers association. So they're trying to engage in this space in a way that workers are happy and willing to engage. So I think that's something they're really trying to do. I guess as with anyone or any organisation trying to play catch-up, it's a bit harder when you're coming from behind. So the Teamsters have certainly been trying to engage in the same way that these workers who are working for Uber and other rideshare organisations are engaging with their employer. And I think that's really the way forward. So far, you know, these are quite small scale, but they certainly, you know, show what unions need to try to be doing. And I guess the difficulty in it is, you know, playing catch up after the event where the organisation has already, you know, had quite a lot of time to establish. But certainly what's happening in Seattle in their attempts to engage with workers shows the way that unions need to be looking.
Sarah Kane, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle. I hope that we can continue this conversation because it seems to be an ever-developing phenomenon that we should continue to study.
Indeed, and thank you for having me.
Sarah Kane, she's Associate Professor at the University of Technology in Sydney, Australia, and she's been studying the global phenomenon of the so-called sharing economy.